The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Hillary Hurd, and this is the Lawfare Podcast.
Switch.
The impeachment trial of President Donald Trump is set to begin in the Senate on Tuesday. And there's been a lot of debate about what exactly counts as an impeachable offense. So I dug into that for Lawfare. And without further ado, here is The Sordid History of Impeachment, read by me, the author, Hillary Hurd. Tipsy on the bench, cursing at the God Almighty, making intemperate speeches about Congress, sexual assault, tax evasion, prostituting high office to his lust for private gain, even staying on the bench when one state secedes from the Union. A Netflix show? A dime store Civil War novel? No, it's actually the history of impeachment. When experts write about impeachment, they tend to spend a lot of time on the founding. What did the founders mean by the words high crimes and misdemeanors? What is an impeachable offense? Does impeachment require a criminal act? Is every criminal act impeachable? These conversations are important, and they're endlessly fascinating, theoretically. But there's another way to think about the impeachable offense, by looking at the offenses for which Congress has actually impeached people. The House of Representatives on January 15th transferred the Articles of Impeachment against Donald Trump to the Senate for trial. How do these articles stack up against more than 200 years of impeachment in actual practice? Since the founding, the House has impeached 20 office holders, 15 federal judges, one senator, one cabinet member, and, as of December 2019, three presidents. Of that list, only 8 people were ultimately convicted by the Senate and removed from office. Many others had the foresight to resign before conviction, although the Senate tried some of them anyway, if only for good measure and perhaps to disqualify them from subsequent office. While most cases involve charges of personal gain, gross misbehavior, or abuse of office in some way, many involve multiple charges, and not all of those charges involve conduct whose evil resonates through the ages. Indeed, the House has impeached over the years any number of officials for being, well, unpleasant. The earliest of these cases involved Judge John Pickering, in 1804 from the U.S. District Court for the District of New Hampshire, who was impeached for drinking on the job. Several decades later, Judge Mark DeLahey was impeached for similar behavior. In the case of Pickering, Article 4 noted that he was, quote, a man of loose morals and intemperate habits who, in the year 1802, being then judge of the District Court in and for the District of New Hampshire, did appear on the bench and of the said court for the administration of justice in a state of total intoxication, produced by the free and intemperate use of intoxicating liquors, and did then and there frequently in a most profane and indecent manner invoke the name of the Supreme Being to the evil example of all good citizens of the United States, and was then and there guilty of other high misdemeanors, disgraceful to his own character as a judge, and degrading to the honor of the United States, end quote. In short, he drank and swore, in addition to handling property claims improperly. Pickering was ultimately convicted and removed from office for his bad behavior. DeLahey, whom the House accused of habitual intoxication, resigned before the Senate could render a final verdict. The case of President Andrew Johnson, our first impeached president, dealt principally with Johnson's decision to fire Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. This was an indictable offense under the 1867 Tenure of Office Act, which was enacted over Johnson's veto to limit the president's ability to fire members of his cabinet. Repealed in 1887, the act is widely regarded today as unconstitutional. But the impeachment articles also catalog Johnson's perennial harangues against the first branch. In language that seems almost comical, the House charged that, quote, Andrew Johnson, as the Chief Magistrate of the United States, did on the 18th day of August in the year of our Lord, 1866, and on divers other days and times, as well as before as afterward, make and deliver with a loud voice certain intemperate, inflammatory, and scandalous harangues, and did therein utter loud threats and bitter menaces as well against Congress, amid the cries, jeers, and laughter of the multitudes then assembled and within hearing. End quote. The addition of Johnson's Trumpy speeches didn't alter the outcome. The Senate ultimately acquitted Johnson, albeit narrowly, after voting on only three of the impeachment articles. The vote on each article was 35-19, one short of the two-thirds majority needed to convict for removal. If these crimes don't sound all that high, these officials aren't the only ones impeached for what we might call low crimes and misdemeanors. One judge, Harry E. Claiborne, mistakenly assumed he could get away with not paying taxes. The House impeached him for failing to report more than $100,000 on his 1979 and 1980 federal income tax returns, and separately, for remaining on the bench after he had been criminally convicted for tax evasion. Ultimately, the Senate removed him from office and he spent time in prison. More severe personal misconduct has also triggered impeachment. In 2009, nearly a decade before the Me Too movement, Judge Samuel B. Kent was impeached for sexually assaulting his female legal aides and then lying about it to the FBI and the Justice Department. He resigned before his trial completed. Not all impeachments involve personal misconduct. Some involve the behavior of judges in their judicial capacities. Many impeachment articles concern the improper use of judicial discretion. For example, Pickering faced articles of impeachment not just for drunken cursing, but also for refusing to allow government witnesses to testify in his court. And Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase, the first and only Supreme Court justice ever impeached, refused to excuse jurors claiming prejudice and denied defendants the opportunity to make their case. Vice President Aaron Burr, who had killed Alexander Hamilton shortly before, showed up at the Senate to preside over Chase's trial. The House alleged that Chase, quote, in the trial of John Fries, charged with treason, did, in his judicial capacity, conduct himself in a manner highly arbitrary, oppressive, and unjust, in consequence of which irregular conduct of the said Samuel Chase, as dangerous to our liberties as it is novel to our laws and usages, the said John Fries was deprived of the right secured to him by the 8th article amendatory of the Constitution, and was condemned to death without having been heard by counsel in his defense to disgrace of the character of the American bench in manifest violation of law and justice and in open contempt of the right of juries on which ultimately rests the liberty and safety of the American people, end quote. Similarly, both Judge James H. Peck and Judge Charles Swain were impeached for abusing their contempt power, though neither was removed from office for it. Peck had charged an attorney with contempt and ordered him to be imprisoned and disbarred because he criticized the judge's legal reasoning in an anonymous letter. Similarly, both Judge James H. Peck and Judge Charles Swain were impeached for abusing their contempt power, though neither was removed from office for it. Peck had charged an attorney with contempt and ordered him to be imprisoned and disbarred because he criticized the judge's legal reasoning in an anonymous letter. Swain similarly was accused of imprisoning and fining lawyers without proper authority, as well as spending the majority of the year outside of his district. The list of such impeachment articles is long. Then there's the case of West H. Humphreys, a federal district judge for several districts in Tennessee, who didn't feel like giving up his office when his state joined the Confederacy. Rather than resign and forgo his federal space, Humphreys accepted a judicial position in the Confederate States of America and changed the flag in his courtroom, all without resigning from the U.S. federal bench. His position could not be filled since he had not vacated it, and Humphreys busied himself ordering multiple people arrested for failing to swear allegiance to the Confederate States of America. Wanting to maintain some semblance of the Union presence in Tennessee, but unable to replace Humphreys' position absent a formal resignation, Congress impeached him in 1862. There were 7 articles against him, including, quote, Article 1, West H. Humphreys did endeavor by public speech to incite revolt and rebellion against the Constitution and government of the United States, and did then and there publicly declare that it was the right of the people of said state, by an ordinance of secession, to absolve themselves from all allegiance to the government of the United States, the Constitution, and laws thereof. Article 6. West H. Humphrey with intent to subvert the authority of the government of the United States, to hinder and delay the due execution of the laws of the United States, and to oppress and injure citizens of the United States, did unlawfully act as a judge of an illegally constituted tribunal within said state called the District Court of the Confederate States of America, and as judge of said tribunal then and there assumed and exercised powers unlawful and unjust, to wit, in causing one Perez Dickinson, a citizen of said state, to be unlawfully arrested and brought before him, as judge of said alleged court of said Confederate States of America, and then required him to swear allegiance to the pretended government of said Confederate States of America, end quote. He was found guilty and removed from office. And a lot of impeachments are about money. In fact, it was money that caused the Senate to debate whether impeachment could reach members of Congress. Back in the 1790s, Britain and Spain were at war. The U.S. had officially adopted a position of neutrality. But Senator William Blunt of the new state of Tennessee wasn't interested in neutrality. He had significant debt and believed he could make more money from Western land prices if Britain controlled what is now part of modern-day Louisiana and Florida. Unfortunately, Blunt's plan, which involved inciting the Cherokee and Creek nations to attack the Spanish, lacked subtlety. And a letter he wrote describing it made its way to President John Adams. The House impeached him in July 1797 for his efforts to, quote, conspire and contrive to excite the Creek and Cherokee nations of Indians to commence hostilities against his Catholic Majestic, as well as against the United States. The Senate then voted to expel Blunt and, as if the political sanction wasn't clear enough, decided to try him as well, before dismissing his case. While there is a general, albeit perhaps mistaken, acceptance now that senators can't be impeached, the Senate failed to precisely resolve that question at the time. While high crimes and misdemeanors is left undefined in the Constitution, Article 2 names bribery, along with treason, as a proper ground for impeachment. And bribery has a certain pride of place in the history of impeachment. In 1876, William W. Belknap, the Secretary of War under President Ulysses Grant, was impeached for appointing an individual to maintain a military trading post at Fort Sill in Indian Territory in exchange for regular payments of more than $20,000 per year, close to $500,000 in today's dollars. Belknap had maintained a lavish lifestyle for many years, hosting infamous parties, and no one could square how his government's salary financed his lifestyle. Though Belknap rushed to resign before the House impeached him, the House proceeded to issue articles against him anyway for, quote, criminally disregarding his duty as Secretary of War and basely prostituting his high office to his lust for private gain, end quote. Like Blunt, Belknap resigned before the trial began, but the House managers ultimately called 40 witnesses anyway. Mitch McConnell wasn't majority leader then, before the Senate acquitted him. More than 30 years later, in 1912, the House impeached Robert W. Archbold, an associate judge on the U.S. Commerce Court. Archbold had used his position to secure concessions from the coal and railroad industries. The House found that, among other things, Archbold had purchased land from the Erie Railroad Company while it was defending itself in a case before him. The Senate ultimately removed Archbold, making it the first time that a corruption-related offense led to removal from office. Over the next few decades, the House impeached federal judges Harold Lauterbach, George W. English, and Halstead Ritter on charges of favoritism in the appointment of bankruptcy receivers. But no one lost their robe because of that favoritism charge. While the Senate did remove Ritter from office for bringing, quote, his court into scandal and disrepute, end quote, it ironically acquitted him of all the articles enumerating what that scandal actually was. More recently, in 2010, the House impeached Judge G. Thomas Porteous on charges of bribery and conflicts of interest during his tenure as a state and federal judge. Article 1 charged Porteous with failing to recuse himself from the Lifemark Hospitals of Illinois, Inc. v. Legerberg Enterprises case, given his relationship with two lawyers at the firm Amato and Creeley. In effect, Porteous, quote, failed to disclose that he appointed Amato's law partner as a curator in hundreds of cases, and thereafter requested and accepted from Amato and Creeley a portion of the curatorship fees with which it had been paid. During the period of the scheme, the fees received by Amato and Creeley amounted to approximately $40,000, and the amounts paid by Amato and Creeley to Judge Porteous amounted to approximately $20,000, end quote. Meanwhile, shady dealings continued after the trial. Quote, While he had the case under advisement, he solicited and accepted things of value from both Amato and his law partner, Creeley, including a payment of thousands of dollars in cash. Thereafter, and without disclosing his corrupt relationship with the attorneys of Amato and Creeley, or his receipt from them of cash and other things of value, Judge Porteous ruled in favor of their client, Legerberg, end quote. But Porteous had cronies besides Amato and Creeley to grease the bench. In particular, he had his bail bondsman, Louis Marcotte III. As Article 2 describes, quote, as part of this corrupt relationship, Judge Porteous solicited and accepted numerous things of value, including meals, trips, home repairs, and car repairs, for his personal use and benefit, while at the same time taking official actions that benefited the Marcottes. These official actions by Judge Porteous included, while on the state bench, setting, reducing, and splitting bonds as requested by the Marcottes and improperly setting aside or expunging felony convictions for two Marcotte employees, end quote. Yesterday, Pelosi called on two House managers in Porteous's case, Representatives Adam Schiff and Zoe Lofgren, to prosecute the case against Trump in the Senate. Finally, there are the liars. A common downfall of judges and presidents alike has been lying, whether to courts, to the FBI, or to Congress. In 1989, for example, the House adopted 17 articles against Elsie L. Hastings, then a federal judge for the Southern District of Florida, and now a Democratic member of Congress, who voted to impeach President Trump, mostly for perjury. 7 years prior, Hastings had been indicted for soliciting a $150,000 bribe in exchange for reducing the sentence of two felons. While he was ultimately acquitted in criminal court of the bribery, suspicions arose that he might have lied and falsified evidence to obtain the acquittal. A special committee of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit began a probe which, after 3 years, found Hastings guilty of perjury, tampering with evidence, and bribery. The House impeached him, and the Senate voted to remove Hastings from office. But there was a hitch. Surprisingly, Hastings' removal did not disqualify him from holding other government positions, and he subsequently ran for Congress and is now the longest-serving member of the Florida delegation. That same year, Walter Nixon, a federal judge for the Southern District of Mississippi, was impeached after being convicted of lying to a federal grand jury about his efforts to benefit a wealthy son's friend by influencing a prosecutor to delay investigating the son's drug smuggling operation. Unlike Hastings, who was acquitted by a grand jury, Nixon went to prison, where he continued to collect his salary until he was formally impeached and removed from office. Similarly, President Clinton was impeached on two charges, lying to a grand jury in 1999 and obstructing a federal investigation, though he was ultimately acquitted by the Senate. On each charge, a handful of Republicans joined a solid Democratic bloc in voting for acquittal, 55-45 for acquittal on the perjury charge and 50-50 on the obstruction charge. Porteous was not only impeached for his dealings with his favored bail bondsman and dinner companion, he was also charged with making false and misleading statements to the U.S. Senate and the FBI about his illicit relationships with attorneys. The Senate removed him and disqualified him from holding future office. Over the years, the House of Representatives has used its power of impeachment to bring charges against a wide array of knaves, actual or alleged, and sometimes against political opponents for wide-ranging acts and allegations. Though these charges lack precedential value in a legal and practical sense, they illustrate just how malleable an impeachable offense can be, proving, in the words of then-Representative Gerald Ford, that an impeachable offense is, quote, whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be, at any given moment in history, end quote. But just because impeachment offenses cover broad political terrain doesn't imply that all distinctions are irrelevant. After all, that Congress has found an offense impeachable doesn't guarantee that the Senate will consider it sufficiently grave to warrant removal and or disqualification. So a better question perhaps is, what kind of impeachment do we have now? Would we consider the decision to condition military aid on the investigation of a political rival to be more like Pickering's drinking on the bench? A trivial, almost comical decision that will be ample fodder for wry jokes in 2050? Or would we consider it to be more like Humphrey's and Blunt's behavior, which, though perhaps comical in their wanton brazenness, involved the use of their power and station to undermine the U.S. government? The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please take this opportunity to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review on the podcast app of your choice. Our audio engineer this week was Jacob Schultz. The editor was Michaela Fogel, and the Lawfare podcast is produced by Jen Patya-Hal. As always, thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.